Hey, you guys. Oh, look, Pookie's joining us on the show.
Yeah, she's down there messing with me.
She just came. Her. Yeah, she just came in because she's like, oh, it's time for us to do the show. She was sleeping. She's going, That's all she ever does. She doesn't meow a lot. She just makes that noise all the time. She's always doing that. Yeah, aren't you, Pookie? She's like, that's right. Why are you talking about me like that?
She knows we're talking about her.
Yeah, of course she does. She's like, that's right. I'm the star. I'm the star. But, yeah. Fourth Throw Down. What the heck is going on in this movie? Yeah, so...
I was like, this is a French porn movie, isn't it? I was waiting for the girls to go at each other.
He kept saying, it's like the opening, one of the opening scenes of this movie where like all the schoolgirls are coming down and the stairs and they're just, he's like, is this going to turn into a French porn movie? He's probably like, I hope. I'm like, no, it's not a French porn movie.
So
like,
I've seen these movies before.
Is Emmanuel going to be in this? No. Yeah. This is Picnic at Hanging Rock. This came out in 1975, directed by Peter Weir. This is actually an Australian film.
Yeah.
One of the first movies that kind of like introduced the Australian New Wave to the rest of the world. Honestly, this is, I saw this movie like a really long time ago, and I remember really, really digging it. Like, it's just hard to explain. It has this really like creepy, unsettling, eerie kind of vibe to it. I will say, if you're not into like ambiguous horror, then you probably won't like it, because you'll be like, what the fuck? And even at the time, I think like some audiences and some, even though this did actually do very well at the box office and actually critically as well, but there were some critics and some audiences were like, what the fuck? Like, you never figure out what happened and stuff like that, which I will kind of get into, because you do actually kind of figure out, or you do actually kind of like learn what happens in the, not in the original novel, but in the original end chapter of the original novel, which was not published until later.
Workman's here. I'm going to have to go let him in.
Oh, okay.
And take care of this. You can handle this. I don't really have much to say about this movie, but I'm going to have to direct him.
Well, okay. We'll come back when you can come back. Okay. Yeah, okay. So I forgot that he was like coming by today. So yeah, Cheryl said I just saw this. So yeah, so I hadn't seen it for a really long time. So I was really looking forward to rewatching it. And because somebody reminded me that it was took place on Valentine's Day, I was like, oh, we should do it for right around Valentine's Day, even though that was yesterday, but whatever. So the thing about this is that, I mean, if you don't know, if you've never seen this story, and like I said, I'm gonna spoil it, so, because it's old. So you have like a group of English schoolgirls in 1900, and they're actually at this school, like Appleyard College, which I guess like some kind of private finishing school or something of that nature. And it's in Australia. And one day, these Valentine's Day in 1900, all of these schoolgirls, or most of them, go on an outing to a place called Hanging Rock, which is a real place in Australia. It's in Victoria, I believe. And it used to be, like, it used to be a volcano. I just don't think it's an active volcano anymore. But it, so it's a, like a weird, like, geological formation. So they go on this picnic, and subsequently, a handful of them, even though they're not supposed to, they go up and explore the rock. And the whole thing is just very, like, weird and ambiguous. And they disappear, and they are never found. Cheryl said it doesn't seem like a Tom movie anyways. Yeah, it's definitely not. Camp Guy said Dennis Rader's coming to install a burglar alarm. Yeah, probably. I don't know if he has to come inside, because I thought he was just doing landscaping today. But then Tom said something about, well, he might have to measure windows. And I was like, yeah, but if he's doing landscaping, wouldn't he be measuring the windows from the outside and not have to come in and measure them from the inside? I mean, they're the same size inside as outside. I don't know what the fuck's going on. I don't know. He set all that up and I didn't know it was happening. But I'm pretty sure it's the landscaper, but he's like telling him what to do. So essentially, you know, don't think that there's going to be a resolution of the mystery. You never find out. Like, one of the girls is found later, unharmed, but she doesn't remember what happens. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's good.
He's good.
He's good.
Didn't he have to measure windows? But he can do that from the outside. He does that from the outside, right?
No, he's going
to
do it from the inside, but he said when the show's over.
Oh, okay.
Down and get him. He'll do it. He doesn't need me or anything. He's got his orders. I didn't know if he needed help moving that thing.
Oh, okay.
That big old planner.
All right.
But he doesn't.
Yeah, somebody said that Dennis Rader was coming to install a burglar.
Sure.
Yeah. So don't go into this thinking that you're going to figure out what happens at the end of the mystery, because you don't. You never do find out. One of the girls is found later, but she doesn't remember what happens. So what the fuck is going on? Okay, so this was based on a novel that came out in 1967 that was written by Joan Lindsay. Now, I haven't read the novel, but I did read a plot synopsis of it, and then I read something about it on Wikipedia. Now, when this book came out, this is very interesting because it's almost kind of like, you know how everybody thinks like metafiction and like found footage and that kind of shit is kind of like a new thing? Not really, because this book, she uses real locations like Hanging Rock, which, as I said, is a real location in Australia. And she frames this story as though it's something that really happened. Like, this was an actual mystery. All these English schoolgirls went out to this outing, and some of them disappeared and were never found, and we never figured out what happened to them. And so she sets it up like it's a real thing, but it's a fictional story, but she's trying to portray it as though this is almost kind of like, not necessarily like a true crime type of thing, but like it really happened. Now, interestingly, she wrote a final chapter of the book in which you kind of figure, like, in which it kind of explains what happens a little bit. Now, this is hinted at in the movie, because if you watch the movie, there's a lot of weird stuff. You suspect that something probably supernatural is going on, because when the schoolgirls get to the site, there's something kind of like otherworldly about it. Like, there's these weird, like,
she knocked that over, that orange thing.
It's just like a little pumpkin. It's fine.
Okay. She tried to eat it.
Oh, well, don't let her eat it. I mean, I don't, it's just like a little foam pumpkin.
Yeah, she thought that was food.
Oh, okay. Yeah, please don't eat that. She's like, screw it, I'll make it food.
Yeah, yeah. That's
what it is. I'll make anything food. That's too big for her to eat, I think. I would hope.
She was chewing on it.
Oh, I don't want her to choke on it, though. But yeah, so you suspect that there's something a little weird going on, because there's like a weird, like, whoa kind of noise. And a couple of the characters mention that their watches have all stopped at 12 o'clock. And also one of the teachers, Miss McCraw, who is actually one of the ones that also disappears later, like along with the school girls, they kind of have this conversation on the way there about time and about, so there's all of this weird shit about time and everything. So they do kind of like hint that whatever force is going on at this rock is kind of like, almost kind of like a portal or a vortex or some kind of thing where people can just be like sucked through and are never found. So they're almost kind of like pulled into another dimension. That's sort of hinted at. And if you read the final chapter of the book, which wasn't actually published when the book was published, but was actually published later, like as a short story or like an addendum, and I think it was called The Mystery of Hanging Rock or something like that, she does actually strongly hint that there is a supernatural thing going on. Like the girls go up there and like throw their corsets over the cliff and like the corsets like float. So it's almost kind of like some supernatural thing. And when I was like researching this, I didn't realize, but if you go on YouTube and you search Picnic at Hanging Rock, I think it's the Lost Ending, Peter Weir did actually shoot an ending in which you see Mrs. Appleyard, who is the older, like the headmistress of the school, because, you know, in the regular cut of the theatrical cut of the movie, they just have a voiceover at the end that says, you know, they found her at the base of the rock as though she had fallen or jumped or whatever, but they don't show any of that. They did shoot a scene where you see her actually going to the rock, like in all her mourning clothes, and she sees Sarah, who is the character that died, like earlier on. You know what I mean? She jumped through the thing and fell through the greenhouse. So again, and then she crawls into a thing in the rock, and so you're meant to assume that this rock is kind of like a portal of some kind, So there is a supernatural explanation, is what I'm saying, but the reason I think that she left this last chapter out of the book, and why Peter Weir chose to leave that scene out of the end of the movie, I think they liked to leave it ambiguous. And also, I think that not only does Hanging Rock represent in the movie like a vortex or a portal to another dimension, I think there's also kind of like something about it almost represents like chaos or like indifferent nature is what I'm trying to get at. Because there's a lot of dichotomy in this movie about all the English characters who are all very upright and very, you know, there's scenes of like all the girls putting their corsets on. Mrs. Appleyard has that perfect fucking hair. Everyone is very, very proper and everything. Whereas the Australian characters, you know, and somebody pointed out that it was the same guy who was in Wolf Creek, Mick Taylor. Yeah, he was really, really young in this, playing Albert, who's kind of like a working class Australian guy. So the Australian characters in the Australian setting are sort of like wild and chaotic, and it's kind of contrasted against like these English settlers who are there who are very, very upright. So it's almost kind of like this rock, the fact that these two girls and this woman, because one of the girls does get found later on, but she doesn't remember what happens, but the two girls and the woman that don't come back, it's implied that they never say what happens to them, but I think it's just because it's the movie's making a statement about that's what life is like the chaotic. You don't like always get an answer to what, like sometimes people just vanish and you never find out what happens to them. So it's almost kind of like making a statement about like, again, like the indifference of nature, the indifference of life, just the chaotic element to it. Also, and I don't see a lot of reviewers bring this up, but I do think, you know, with the whole thing, with the contrast between the very, very strict, upright British characters and the more wild, like, Australian environment and the Australian characters, I think that there's a little bit of an implication going on there, too, that whatever chaos is going on at Hanging Rock, it has a sexual component to it as well, like almost like a Pan type of thing, like a nature spirit, because the character of Sarah, the orphan, is actually really into Miranda, one of the girls that later disappears. And it's implied, I don't know if I'm just reading this into it, but it's implied that there's a sexual tension or some kind of sexual feeling between the two of them, the two girls, which would not have been proper during this time period. There's also, I felt like, a little bit of sexual tension between the upright English guy who gets obsessed with the girl's disappearance and goes to look for them, Michael, and the Australian hunky, more wild, working class carriage driver guy, Albert. I kind of got a little bit of sexual tension between them as well. So I kind of feel like they're maybe making a statement between, you know, maybe that this mountain or this geological formation representing, again, wildness, chaos. So some people might actually want that, because it does seem like Miranda and the other girls, as they climb the mountain, like before they disappear, they start shedding their clothing, like this, you know, this very restrictive English clothing that they have with all the stockings and the shoes and the corsets and all the layers and everything. So they start like taking their shoes off, they start taking their stockings off, they take their corsets off as they're going up, and they're going up like barefoot, and they almost go willingly. And, you know, in Miranda, you find out, like one of the girls that disappears, Sarah says of her later, she knew that she wasn't going to come back. So it's almost kind of like they went there and like they chose that. Like, you know what I mean? They chose to go into the chaos or into the wildness, and it's like you never find out what happens to them. But like I said, if you read the original end chapter that was cut out of the book, and if you look a little bit, because I saw like the end, you know, the ending that they shot for the movie that they didn't use, and that's not as clear, but it, the implication is that this place is like a vortex of some type, which again is implied because they do talk a lot about time and, you know, and that kind of thing. So you know that there's some kind of like supernatural interdimensional shit going on. But as I said, I think they wanted to leave that unclear so that you could have more of like a symbolic type of thing. Because you can read into it a lot of ways. But like I said, I'm pretty sure that rock like symbolizes again, like, chaos, or like an indifferent universe, I guess. And that's the reason that they kind of contrasted, you know, this, that's why these characters being, you know, set in this time period, 1900, being very, very proper English people, like, you know, and they're colonists, essentially, like, in this Australian wild that they're not really all that comfortable with. I think that's kind of why that dichotomy is in there as well. Yeah, Slasher Fred says, or a wormhole. And, yeah, Slasher Fred says, the original Blair Witch Project kind of sets up, like, a true story. Yeah, and I kind of feel like this... It's interesting because the book did that as... The book of this did that as well. She absolutely, like, the author absolutely presented this as a true story, and she used real things in it, like real locations and stuff. Even though some stuff you knew wasn't real because... I was reading one thing that said, you know, Valentine's Day of 1900, which in the movie is portrayed as a Saturday, I think, but like in real life it was a Wednesday. So obviously this stuff didn't really happen, but she kind of like made it seem like a real thing. And I think later on when people asked her, because it did actually go into folklore in Australia as maybe this is something that actually really did happen and that she wrote a book about it. But when she had people ask her later on, is this a true story? Did you base this on a true story? She said, don't ask me that question. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Because she wanted to, I guess, like, make a statement against maybe, like, the, you know, the whole line between fiction and nonfiction being very porous.
Yeah.
And she just said, it doesn't really matter. Like, you can take whatever you want out of the story. It doesn't matter if it actually really happened or not.
It's a well-made movie. It looks really good. It's got good... cast, the acting is good. It's very classical. It looks very, very British, kind of period piece. But it violated too many of my rules. All right, like if it doesn't pull me in the first 5 or 10 minutes, I'm never gonna get pulled into it. So as it started to go, it started to do shit that I didn't understand, and mystery started to happen. But by that point, I didn't care. So I started just kind of checking out from it. Kind of like an Agatha Christie type mystery weird shit going on, but by the time I realized what kind of movie it was, I didn't care anymore. So I just started looking at my tablet and stuff. Just, it's not my kind of movie, but I can understand some people, this might be, they might be into this.
Yeah, it's like, basically, it's just, and like I said, I didn't even know this until recently, but they did remake it in 2018. I don't know if the remake is any good or not, but... Yeah, if you don't like, and actually this movie was really like influential on certain types of, particularly Sofia Coppola, her movies like The Virgin Suicides in particular, like took a lot from this. It looks almost, and even Marie Antoinette to a lesser degree. But it just goes to show that this type of movie, yeah, this is definitely one that, if you don't like ambiguity in movies, then, you know, it's just going to make you mad because the mystery is not resolved. Although, as I said, there are hints and you can kind of bring your own thing to it. But, you know, if you like everything very straightforward and spelled out, then no, then you will not be into this movie. This movie is a whole vibe, and you're either going to vibe with it or you're not going to vibe with it. It looks like... As I said, it's set in 1900. It looks like it just looks like this pastoral painting almost. You know what I'm saying? And it's very like hazy and like soft focus. And everything is just kind of engineered to, whether it's like the sound design or the score. Oh, the score by Zamfir, Master of the Pan Flute. Do you guys like remember? Because you mentioned something about the music, and I said it's Zamfir, Master of the Pan Flute. I was like, don't you remember? Well, don't you remember, like, in the 80s, they had those fucking infomercials where they were selling his albums and stuff, but this was before he became kind of like a punchline.
Yeah,
I guess.
Funny is that she throws in his title, Master of the Pan. Well, that was only on the channel.
I wasn't sure if you remembered
exactly
who Zamfir was. That's why I added that, so you would remember.
Today we said Zamfir, over and over again, in the damn fucking Master of the Pan Flute. You know, and then they're showing all the fucking.
Yeah, he laughed at me when I said Master of the Pan Flute.
I just started laughing.
Well, because like I said, when I just said Zamfir, I didn't know if you'd remember who that was. Because sometimes you don't remember
things. Exactly who Zamfir is.
I was like, yeah, from the infomercials. But like I said, this came out in 1975. This was like way before the infomercial thing.
Zamfir was only famous
because of the damn infomercial. He bought that shit. Fucking, he wasn't famous before that shit.
So if so, he was a genius because he might have made like millions of dollars from those.
Probably did.
And look, like kids, people like us still that were kids at the time still remember Zamfir Master of the Pan Flute.
Just goes to show that a motherfucker can appear out of nowhere, claiming to be fully formed, a fucking master of the shit, world renowned and famous and shit. Nobody knows who this dude is.
He did movie scores.
But
it's
he
just
became famous.
He became famous because of that.
Because of that, yeah.
He was known in movie circles because he had done some movie scores, right, including this one. But he wanted to be worldwide famous,
right.
Just for not, like, you want to be so famous that you're like a punchline and everybody knows who that is, because that's how you know you've arrived. But it is just funny that I still remember that because
he was the Fabio of musicians.
Fabio, that was another fucking
Fabio
dude
just
that
appeared. He made himself famous for being famous.
He was famous because he was the cover model for
all the fucking
paintings,
right.
On the
but it's ridiculous.
Romance
it's
novels.
Ridiculous. But that's not what made him famous. What made him famous was fucking butter. Artificial butter made that motherfucker famous.
That's true. He can't believe it's not butter. Getting hit in the face by a goose. Wasn't it a goose?
Yeah.
On a roller coaster?
I mean, he did a lot of modeling for the cover of those fucking...
Yeah, he was on... Man, he was on so many of
those. Nobody knew who that dude was.
But like I said, if you're that famous, I wasn't a big romance novel reader.
Right.
There was a whole subset of, like, middle-aged ladies who knew who he was. They might not have known his name, but they were hey, it's that dude again.
It's that dude, right.
Like, on the cover. Because he was on a shit ton. Yeah. I couldn't believe it.
His name recognition happened when he's fucking doing butter commercials.
I can't believe it's not butter, right? Was it Country Crock? I think it was I can't believe it's not butter.
That's how he got name recognition.
Man,
that's where it made
they even made him a joke on Mystery Science Theater. They did a sketch where they had like the Fabio kit.
Yeah.
Where it came with a wig and muffiny chest piece.
Okay.
And they did like a little commercial for it where they all went, Fabio, Fabio.
Yeah.
Like throwing their hair around.
Yeah.
Oh, and it had a chin too.
Did it have a fucking Roman nose?
I don't think it had a nose. I think it had a chest piece and a chin and a wig.
Yeah,
and maybe that was it. I can't remember. I can't remember what episode that was from. It was a Mike episode, so it was like post. Yeah, it was probably season 6.
I'm sure Zamfir fucking did some shows for some rich people up in their fucking mansions and cut a few albums, but the average person didn't know who Zamfir was until...
But now they do.
Until they did that
until the 80s.
They brought that shit to the trailer park.
Yeah. Everybody's like, ooh, that's pretty.
Every middle-aged woman in the fucking trailer park buying a damn double album.
Look, I'm classy.
Classy now.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, listening to El Condor Pasa.
Genius.
Fucking Pan Flute version. Yeah. Fuck out of here, man. Get the fuck out of here.
It's pretty, though. Okay. It's funny because I had forgotten that Zamfir had done the music for Picnic at Hanging Rock. And when I was, like, listening to it, and I was like, oh, my, holy shit, it's Zamfir. And I was like, that is really pretty, though. It's easy to say it's pretty now because we passed the time when it was, like, cheesy. Because in the 80s, because it was an infomercial,
that shit was cheesy.
It was, like, cheesy as fuck. But now you can actually, like, appreciate it. There is other... It's not all Zamfir. They actually do use some other classical pieces in this.
It's a lot of studio musicians that play that shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're out there. A lot of them are down in Central and South America. Like, Chile and in the Andes regions, they do the flutes. All different kinds of flutes. So that's... Dudes from the fucking favelas playing that. Playing it on the street in Brazil, making coins. I remember it, you know what I mean? Back in the 80s, that shit was just real common. Dudes from Peru with the fucking woven hats out there playing on the street, doing pan flutes and shit.
Yeah, yeah,
and fucking ocarinas and shit, you know? Because that's their...
I wondered if guys like that, like in the 80s, were they pissed that like Zamfir made everything super cheesy?
Yeah, step on the dick, you know? They're like, dude, what happened to my shit, you know? And
he's like, man, I'm an artiste, what the fuck? Now you're just like making it like so you can put it on the fucking infomercial and now like, you know, Cletus at the fucking trailer park is buying the
albums. I know what it is when I see it. I know what it is when I see it. You cannot lie to the vanilla gorilla. I know what it is.
Shit, okay.
Honky Kong.
It's Honky, yeah.
Honky Kong.
I like Honky Kong.
Honky Kong. Still got to make my Honky Kong shirt.
Yeah, we got to do that. Like I said, I have to make a little... I need to take a picture of you that I can, like, pixelate. You know what I mean? Like, a clear enough one, like you doing a Donkey Kong pose that I can make
into
little
pixels. No, just take
Donkey
Kong and just put my face on it.
Well, okay.
You know what I mean? But you got to stretch it or something. Well, nah, don't worry about it.
That's what I mean.
Don't worry about it.
I can
copyrighted.
Do it.
Just copyright the whole thing. Just put Donkey Kong on there and just... change it to Honky Kong and put the fuck... People don't even know what it is. I don't even know if the average person would know what we were talking about. Maybe they would.
Yeah, they probably would.
What Donkey Kong is. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure everybody knows what Donkey Kong is.
They still know what Donkey Kong is.
Yeah, even though it was like the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, Adriana says, payoff in this movie isn't worth it. Yeah, it's... I think it is. I really, like I said, I'm really a big fan of ambiguity in horror. Not always. You can't just make an ambiguous horror movie and go, uh-huh. But you know what I mean? I think that there's enough clues in this for the implication to become fairly clear, like what the hell is going on. Because like I said, even if you don't have... the luxury of knowing what the end of the book was, or, you know, that wasn't published until later, you still know that it's some kind of, like, time displacement or some kind of, like, portal or interdimensional kind of shenanigans going on. So that is pretty clear. And like I said, you know, this movie, I can understand, like, if it pisses some people off because they're like, well, the mystery isn't resolved, but... as I said, the mystery not being resolved, I think, is kind of, like, the point of the movie, because they're saying, yeah, like, in real life, like, shit like this happens all the time. There's, like, a mystery, and it doesn't get resolved, and you just have to, like, deal with it. So there's that kind of thing, too.
Adriana says that the acting is hammy and cheesy. It's very British stagey. That's all BBC.
Well, interestingly, though, a lot of the girls in this, they picked them for how they looked, rather than... because they wanted them all to look kind of, like, ethereal and innocent, sort of. Because that was kind of another thing, and that was another little undercurrent, and that's what I was saying before, where I think that kind of, like, quote-unquote, like, wild sexuality was kind of a component of what was going on with the whole, like, wildness of whatever this Hanging Rock was. Like I said, a nature-type thing.
So it goes back to the French porn flick. It's like...
well, no, but, well, because...
porn casting.
Because there was a lot of lines in this...
yeah.
About, you know, one of the girls they found, or her corset was missing. So there was a lot of stuff about them, like, taking their clothes off. The older woman who also vanished, Miss McGraw, or whatever her name was, McCraw, you know, they saw her later, and she just had, like, her pantaloons on, which was very scandalous. And also there was kind of stuff about... Where it was kind of like the doctors, when they found, like, the girl, they're always saying, well, she was intact, meaning she wasn't raped. Because I feel like there was a whole like subtext of, like, sexual violence going on. Like, maybe they all got spirited away and, like, raped to death. There was a lot of kind of stuff like that sprinkled throughout here too. So that's kind of what I'm saying, that why I think that Hanging Rock, as, you know, the geological formation, because it used to be a volcano, like, in real life it did, and so it represents this sort of, like, wildness. Of nature and indifference of nature, but also kind of, like, sexual liberation, but also sexual violence is in that mix as well.
Yeah, I didn't get it.
Yeah, well, like I said, this is one where there's dialogue in it, but you really have to kind of listen to all the dialogue, and everything kind of, like, means something. You know what I'm saying? It's that kind of movie where you really kind of have to pick up on a lot of clues that are not really spelled out. And to me, I don't know, that to me that makes it creepier. There's something, like, really unsettling about this. I really, and like I said, I particularly like when they first get to the rock and that sound that the rock makes, that just weird whoa, that kind of sound that it makes. And it's almost kind of like, you know, that there's, like, some weird shit going on there. And they, one of them say, because a lot of their watches stop, like, at noon, and they're talking about, oh, it must be, like, some weird magnetic thing. So that's why I kind of think it's some kind of weird, like, I don't know, like, ley lines, or, like, some weird vortex or some shit like that. I think that's kind of what they're implying, but... you know what I mean? Cheryl says this movie is still a must watch because it influenced so much. Yeah, I mean, this was, again, the first movie that got, like, an international audience of the Australian New Wave. I mean, Peter Weir, he made, he made so many movies. He made Gallipoli. He made, what was that one? The Year of Living Dangerously. Wasn't Mel Gibson in that? He made that. And then later on, he made like some kind of big, he's made The Truman Show. He made Dead Poets Society. So he went on like to much greater things. Most of his movies have actually been quite big hits. But he made one called The Last Wave too, like which an early Australian film, which is also very good. If you haven't seen that, I just saw that not too long ago. But yeah, I would also recommend that one. That one actually might have come out before this one, now that I'm thinking about it. I think Shudder had it for a little while, but I don't know if it's on there anymore. Nostalgic Top Hat says, the ambiguity augments the tension and the horror. Yeah, see, I get if, you know, if some audiences don't like that. Like I said, I'm not shitting on you or judging you or anything like that, because people like different shit, and that's fine. But to me, I think it makes it, like, eerier and more unsettling that you don't, that it's not exactly spelled out to you what's going on, and that the the mystery is not really resolved. You know, I don't know. I like that. So it depends on like what you want from it, I guess. Danny Rowling says, also deemed a Valentine's Day horror film by some. Yeah, that's why we did it today. I was gonna do it yesterday, but we were already doing Valentine, that slasher. Because this, it's not super Valentine-y, but it does take place on Valentine's Day, and there is a little bit of that like toward the beginning. And then Cheryl also says, poor Fabio, that must have hurt, hitting in the face with it. It was a goose, right? Was it a goose or a duck?
I don't remember.
He was on I feel like that was the 90s. Wasn't that the 90s? He was on a roller coaster, and can you imagine, of like all the fucking shit, you're on a roller coaster and he got hit like right in the face by a bird. I think it was a goose.
Okay.
And it broke his nose. And it's kind of sad, because it's like, imagine you're famous and that happens to you. And assholes like me, that's like one of the only things they remember about you, like decades later, like after that happened. How much would that suck?
He was lucky to get known.
I guess.
All right. Especially back in that in the olden days, when the media only had a very narrow bandwidth. It was hard to get known back then. There wasn't many, the media was small, and there wasn't many avenues, you know. Fucking nowadays, a dude like him, he would just be on Instagram.
Yeah, he would just be like an Instagram model.
He'd be an Instagram model.
Yeah, Cheryl said it was a goose. I thought it was.
Right.
Then I questioned myself. I was like, wait, was it a duck? No, it was, I'm pretty sure it was a goose. Yeah, Cheryl says, oh, it's a beautiful location, Hanging Rock. Oh, it was probably a more popular tourist destination after this movie came out. I wondered if it was, because I wasn't really sure. I mean, this came from a novel. The novel came out in 1967, and I didn't know if the novel was popular enough to have, you know, made the location really popular. It's a cool looking place, though. And they did actually shoot it there. Like I said, it's a real location. You can't actually go there. It used to be a volcano. But yeah, I kind of actually wouldn't mind reading the book. It sounds like the movie is a pretty close adaptation. I think there was one little subplot that they left out of the movie, but I don't think it was super important. It sounds like like a pretty close adaptation altogether. Let's see. Adriana says, I liked Spring from 2014. You know what? I've been meaning to watch that. I think I watched like the first few minutes of it and I said, oh, this looks good. I'm going to have to like finish it. And I don't think I ever did. I was actually going to do it this month for folk horror, but I don't know if I'm going to get around to it now. But I think I will eventually get around to it. It is on my list. So, because I hear a lot of people talking about that one. So I definitely do want to see that. So, yeah, let's wait. Oracle says, yeah, the indifferent danger of the great outdoors. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, the indifference of nature. I kind of feel like that's what they're talking about. And then Cheryl says, the heavier girl needs a punch in the face. Yeah, she kind of does. I agree. Yeah, Oracle also says, otherwise known as Mother Nature doesn't even care if she kills you. Yeah, I kind of got the feeling that that was an underlying thing of this movie. All right, so I guess we should probably, like, wrap it up, because I think, like, the landscaper dude probably wants to...
Yeah, he's going to get in here and
measure some windows.
Yeah.
So we got to let him do his thing. So thanks, everybody, for dropping by. It's Tuesday, right? Okay, so tomorrow night we're doing our regular episode. This should be a fun one. We're doing Dr. Kellogg and the Battle Creek Sanitarium.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like all of his like health stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Way ahead of his time, that dude was.
Yeah.
Interestingly. But yeah, that'll be a fun topic.
Yeah.
But yes, because somebody like mentioned it a couple weeks ago, so I put it in the poll in that one.
Yeah, sanitariums were.
Yeah. So that should be fun. So yeah, everybody drop by tomorrow evening and we'll be talking about that. So yeah, have a good rest of your day, you guys. And we will see you guys again tomorrow. Bye.